Here's what you can look forward to in today's episode.
You know, you have to diversify yourself a little bit. You have to diversify your revenue streams. You have to think about, like, you know, how do we adapt for where we're going instead of being stuck where we are.
Over the last decade, the market research industry has been disrupted. Our largest agencies are struggling to keep up as their customers turn to newer, faster, and cheaper data sources. Now, we are on the edge of yet another major market shift. Now is the time for us to reassert ourselves as the rudder of the brands we love. Thank you for tuning in to the Happy Market Research Podcast, where we are charting the path for the future of market researchers and businesses. Hi, I'm Jamin Brazil, and you're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. My guest today is Adam Jolly, EVP Business Development at EMI Online Research Solutions and Market Research Influencer. EMI Research Solutions is a leading provider of online sample for surveys. Adam has a long tenure at EMI and is one of the earliest market research podcasts with 37 episodes starting in January 15, 2018, the IntelliCast podcast, and was also instrumental in me deciding to start Happy Market Research Podcast. Adam, thanks very much for joining me today.
I'm super excited. Thanks for having me. This is kind of like one of the things that, you know, listen to the podcast and think like, I'll never be on somebody else's. I'll never be on yours. And so this is a little bit surreal for me. I love it.
Dude, it's so funny. This is like crossover week for me. I was on Siemens earlier. So.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's so funny. Anyway, hey man, first off, big shout out to your podcast. Thank you so much
for
what you are doing there. It is a great source of information and it honestly just kind of keeps my brain occupied during part of my commute. So anyway, thanks for that.
No, yeah, I'm. That's great to hear because I think like, and you probably kind of felt the same way when you started yours, like you don't really know what expectations are. And where you're going to go. I mean, from when I was first like starting that out and figuring out why would we do it and who would ever listen before and what would we talk about, like things evolve, you know, and it's great to hear like that's the goal. I mean, that's when I listen to podcasts. It's like you're on your commute, you know, you're by yourself and you might as well listen to something. It beats listening to the same three songs over and over again.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Right. Yeah. My guilty pleasures are we have about an acre and we do some farming. Well, we have an acre that we farm. We live on 2 acres. And so I've been doing some tractor work on the weekends. And so that's my like headphones on, podcast. And then also obviously I have about a 30-minute commute each way. And so it's a great opportunity. I just look, literally, I will look forward. Sometimes I'll even get so involved in the podcast. I will sit outside of my house, right? Waiting for the episode to end before I'll go in, which is insane.
Same thing. The driveway time. It's a good
driveway time. That's the thing. Who knew? Like maybe that's the KPI for if you have a good podcast or not. What is your driveway time?
Right.
Listenership driveway time.
Right. That's good.
All right. So from 2003 to 2007, you were getting your bachelor's in marketing at Northern Kentucky University. You were also working as a fundraising recruitment manager at sports service Cincinnati Reds. So how in the world did you wind up in market research?
The biggest thing is I had a professor that really guided me. You know, one thing that I leave out there and I purposely like didn't like change or edit or anything. Like I actually started college in 2000. My college story isn't, my parents is probably the biggest nightmare. To me, it's like the greatest story is that I was in my undergrad forever. Just kind of figuring out life type thing. That's the best way I could put it. But I started out in college and majored in everything. I switched majors all the time. I was just kind of floating through worlds. Thought for a while I really wanted to be a geologist. I was really into like rocks and like density checks and like I was super into it. And then I transferred up. I transferred from Eastern Kentucky to Northern Kentucky University, I kind of started over. Really? Obviously, just bouncing around from major to major, I didn't have anything that came up and started over. And I really made a connection with a professor that was in marketing here. And one thing, Northern Kentucky is probably 20 minutes away from Cincinnati. And Cincinnati kind of has that P&G cup runneth over. And so a lot of people are, when they're recruiting, they go to Northern Kentucky and start looking for things. So, you know, here in town, we've got Directions, a huge Nielsen office, Market Vision, Burke, a ton of primary custom market research companies. And NKU kind of had a little system where they would try to place students. My professor at the time became a mentor to me. He was the, you know, why have you been in college so long? What do you want to do with your life? That type thing. I was working when you're 20 years old, and it sounds really cool to tell people that you work for a baseball team. And so like there was like a contentment in where I was in life, but there was definitely a ceiling in place also. And so he kind of said, don't you expect more? Don't you want to do more? Look at research, like look at what you're doing in research. And it really kind of caught on to me because I was pretty good in math, pretty good at statistics, pretty good in those type of things, but I knew that I could sell. One thing about being in college for so long is like you start to develop like personal, like communication type skills.
Totally.
A little better.
Totally.
And so I remember it all came down to really not knowing what I was going to do. Graduation was coming up, and we had kind of this like speed networking event with all the market research firms in here in town. I remember Rainey Brooks, who started Directions,
oh, yeah.
was like the keynote speaker. And it kind of fired me up a little bit and gave me some encouragement. And going around to the different tables, and I started thinking like, okay, like do I start in like this an analyst? Am I like employee 1800 at Burke or something? You know, that type of talking through. And I ran into Mike Holmes, who started EMI, and Aaron Walton, who was at EMI for 12 years. And Aaron's a year older than me. And we started talking, we had a connection. He's like, it's enough market research, but also like real life type business as well, like selling and things like, you know, kind of business acumen. You might be a good fit. And honestly, he was also a guy that was a year older than me and was driving a Saab at the time.
Wow.
That I was like, oh my, this could be me.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I graduated on Friday and started on Monday. And it was great. I think I was employee like 6 at EMI. And it was something that I just grasped onto, and I started just diving in. I was fascinated by research. I was fascinated by the outcomes of things. I think everyone tries to find their passion in market research when they start. So, for me, it was, I started in 07 and I started doing some primaries for the 08 election. And it was like that real life application of saying, you know, we were doing some providing a sample for polling companies and to see like, you know, Howard Dean wins Vermont. And I was like, oh my gosh. And then I just started to see things happen, like real life implications of what my work was. And that was my buy-in. And that's when I knew like I loved the industry, and I could see what my daily work was having an impact on everything around us, whether it's the economy or polling or, you know, some consumer electronic type company. And I fell in love. I was in.
Back when polling was getting it right.
Right. Back when people respected polling. those were the days.
Still obviously a huge and influential industry, but it's been interesting how it's been struggling more and more and more to nail the outcomes.
The polling industry needs like a PR just refurbish.
Totally.
At the same time.
Totally.
And maybe explain to people what like margin of error is, and maybe not call people for, there's a whole other thing. The polling industry just needs a complete rebranding, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it'll always be a big industry, right? But it's just
right.
Come under so much scrutiny, and for the right reasons, because as you've already pointed
sure.
out, right? You know, you can't say, hey, the sky is red, and then somebody goes outside and crap.
Right. I'm with you.
You don't get to do it too many times in a row anyway, is my point.
Right.
But
I'm with
anyway.
You.
Let's talk about your podcast, IntelliCast Podcast. You started right out the gate this year. Is that correct? 2018?
Right. Yeah.
A lot of episodes, 37 episodes.
Yeah.
Why in the world did you guys decide to spend so much? I mean, this is a big time commitment. I don't think people really recognize the.
No, yeah,
the,
it really is.
Yeah, yeah, the investment it is. So why did you guys decide to do it?
I think I bought all the equipment in like end of October of last year. I had a talk. I've been at EMI, 11 years, and it was like my 10-year mark, and just like transparently just started going through some stuff, maybe like a not like a third life crisis, I don't know. I started like go back and like start looking, like I started like posting things on LinkedIn, I started writing more on LinkedIn and stuff, and started to think like, you know, 10 years in this business and I'm a salesperson, and sometimes when you're a salesperson, no matter what your industry, like you are like just a blank canvas, because you have to be somebody for this client, you have to be somebody for this client. And I wanted to try to build like a something. I wanted to be somebody, the person I was after 5 o'clock. And Mike, again, kind of recognized that and thought, well, what if you started doing some podcasts? Would that be great? And I was like, yeah, that sounds good. So we bought all the equipment, and then it sat in my drawer for months. And I needed like a kick to start doing it. And finally, I was just like, you know what, let's just record one and see how it goes. And I grabbed Brian Lamar, who is our insights guy here, who is just he's a clown in the most endearing term. Somebody who's always there to entertain and is always looking for like some kind of engagement with his audience. And so I knew that he would be perfect for it. And he's also very smart and has 30 years in the industry. And so without him, if I would have just started the podcast myself, which like the initial plan, or if I didn't have him there to be kind of an accountability partner with it, you know, my initial plan was if I ever record it, maybe I do 3 or 4 until people stop asking me when's the next one coming out, and then it goes away. But he keeps me focused. Our marketing guy makes things easy for us as well, and always like has things on our counter, gives us topics. He's always scouring like the MR news type things to see like, what can we talk about? And he keeps us on track as far as timing and everything, and the recording part, he does the editing and all that. And so it really started becoming an easy way. You know, the first step's always the hardest, and sometimes you need somebody to push you off the cliff to take that first step. And those two did it for me and did it for the podcast.
How has it impacted your personal brand?
Greatly. To me, and that's the one thing with our podcast that's so different from, and why I wanted it to be different, is that I wanted to be like a real person. I think so many, and maybe, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier, like when you're a salesperson in the industry, or like, you know, an influencer, if you're someone that speaks at conferences, things like that, like it's hard to walk that line between the, I have to be this and I have to stand who I am and say who, you know, and this is who I need to be to make a revenue, to sell something, to be prosperous in this industry, and then who I really am. And if it's great if those two people are close to each other, you know, if there's not like a huge, like polarizing type thing. And it really, like by being ourselves, and, you know, sometimes we talk about sports, sometimes we do the Mount Rushmore thing as kind of a tongue in cheek joke here, because I rank everything in life. Like if someone said, if we're sitting together and someone's like, oh man, this song's great, and I'll be like, yes, this is my number 14 favorite song of all time. Like I'm always thinking about like ranking things. And so like we do things like that, and it's really grounded me. It's helped my personal brand. It's helped me feel more comfortable about who I am, and try to marry the, you know, for like a panel sake, panel type terminology, the B2B respondent in me and like the consumer respondent in me. It's really helped me kind of balance a little bit more.
What do you think was one of the most difficult parts of your first, I'll say 5 episodes, since you like ranking things, right?
Yeah.
Those early days. What was the thing that really surprised you was super hard?
There's a balance sometime in the, you never want to make anybody mad, you know? So it's tough sometimes when we talk about, you know, a company did this, and to say like, is this a good or a bad decision, or what type of impact we have? And, you know, undoubtedly everyone's everyone's client, everyone's vendor. And so you don't want to say anything that sparks something. And at the same time, we walk the line pretty well, but it's been hard of like, what is EMI's stance on something? You know, I've yet to get a call from a salesperson that was like, hey, you badmouth my client, they'll never spend money with us again.
Right.
But like, it's always kind of a danger, you know, because we are hard on some people. And like, sometimes we talk about the blockchain and people saying that, you know, blockchain is this or blockchain is that, or, you know, this programmatic sampling is this, programmatic sampling is that. Like, we have the, you can come really close. And there's definitely been some deleted segments of things we've talked about.
I have a few deleted segments as well, just for full transparency.
Right. But it's, but I think that that's been a part that has been, it's been very difficult, but then also, you start to equal things out a little bit. It's not been too, it's getting easier and easier.
Yeah. You do find a flow. I got to tell you, one of the things that was really hard for me was listening to my podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. I've always hated the sound of my voice. And so that was hard. And then, like, I'll notice if you listen, like, I listen back, I'll go back and listen to like the first 20, and I said, a lot. And I can't stand it. I get back to
just
like,
want to tear your ears off. You listen to those first ones, right?
Yeah. What are you doing? Like, why are you talking like that? Your voice doesn't sound like that. It's not how you naturally speak. Or I'll use words I've never used before. And I don't know who this is. And there's no one there. I mean, because you're kind of like, even like when we're speaking now, like we're kind of talking into the void. Like we're in like a vacuum with just totally. You and I, like a total just a conversation. And then like I'll listen to it later and be like, oh no, look, oh, there's other people listening to this. Like, what are they going to think when they hear this? I mean, things like that. It was really tough. And to this day, Brian has never listened to a podcast. He's never listened to one of our podcasts before.
Are you serious?
Never has. Leaves the room. We put it on over our speaker system in the office here. And he goes to like the one room that doesn't have a speaker in it and works from there when it's on. He's never listened to it before. And at the same time, like, it's also embarrassing. Like, I went on vacation with my family a while back, and the family will get in the car, like my Bluetooth like will kick on, and like my wife will catch me listening to my podcast, and that's like the most like embarrassing. She's like, "Oh, you just driving around listening to yourself talking? All right, great. Look at you."
Totally. I hooked up. I saw. I was reviewing some YouTube. You'll appreciate this. Some YouTube content where it's basically me talking to a camera, and I hooked up the YouTube to our TV last night, and so it had my account information. The most recent video watched was my me talking to myself, right? So this just miraculously narcissistic view.
Sure, right? It's true. It's good,
but I hate it. Like I cannot stay. I would much rather watch a video. For some reason I become so. It's hard for me to not go into a negative place and become overcritical. But then when I listen to other podcasters who I really like, you know, you could, if you applied that same lens, that same critical lens to them, I'm sure it would be, you know, the same sort of thing. So I think it's just a lot of, probably the biggest lesson for me is give yourself some grace and know that you're not going to do it great and embrace the suck part of it at the early days and just keep learning and do it a little bit better, right?
No, that's great. Yeah, embrace the suck is a really good way to look at it. You know, give yourself some grace and keep developing from it. But it's still like I was at a Wire event the other day, and like somebody came up and was like, "Oh, I really love the podcast." And my first, like, you know, you say thank you, but in my first part, like, I want to dive in. And I was totally. Like, what am I doing wrong? Like, oh my God, do you listen to Seema's? You listen, you know, like, how are we, you know, that type thing, and try to get like the feedback on it. And I guess, yeah, a little bit more grace would go a long way.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I have a game prepared for us today. We all know that digital coin is the currency of the future. At least that's what everybody's telling me.
That's what everybody says.
So here we go. You're a VC. That is a venture capitalist, and you're looking to invest in future tech for market research. You have 10 Atom Bucks. Atom Bucks, by the way, are the coin of choice for this future world of ours.
Got it. Love it.
You have 7 options. The first one is virtual reality or VR. Yeah. The second one is augmented reality, AR. Qualitative at scale is the third one. The fourth category is voice. The fifth is big data. Sixth is traditional trackers. Seventh is blockchain. So we have 7 things really quick. Your objective is to maximize your shareholder return in a 5-year period starting from today. So we're 2018. So whatever that is, 23, 24. And you want to invest your 10 Atom bucks. You can put them all in one of these seven categories, or you can distribute them around. So it's VR, AR, qualitative at scale, voice, big data, traditional trackers, and blockchain. Gotcha. Where would you make your investments?
I would only invest in four of them. And my thought process here is that they're all kind of connected. I would, so some of these things, like to me, VR, AR, and to a sense, big data are kind of almost seem like end games to me in our industry. And what I mean by that is, like, I feel like if we were to invest and we really got the most out of them, and we really, you know, if we had more of like machine learning type and like AI, then you start to eliminate a little bit more of the human element of it, which this is like a huge, you know, as much as this is a math industry, it's definitely a human industry as well, and learning the behaviors. And so I wonder, like, if I were to invest in that, I feel like there's a ceiling. You know, like, I feel like there's like the, it's almost to an end game to where like maybe the returns wouldn't be as great. I definitely feel like maybe the money's going to be huge. But as far as returns on it, I just don't know if this, especially like if it were to go to beyond 5 years, I think it would be huge in 3 years, maybe 5 years, then it's kind of plateaued out. So that's how I feel about those. But the one that I would not give any money to is traditional trackers. And the reason,
man, just cut them off at the knees.
Yeah, I'm out on traditional tracker. And I will say that, and this is, I mean, I'll say that as a sample company who does a lot of traditional trackers and loves them and loves the renewing revenue, and please give us more of them, the best. But at the same time, it doesn't make a ton of business sense in the way things are like progressing, and that, and a couple of different layers there is that I think the idea of a traditional tracker, this pulse type thing, it's almost you're spending the money to spend the money. And I don't know if enough changes is happening in the marketing or in any type of influence or, you know, whatever the context is, to where you constantly need to be measuring something over and over again. And I think if people really looked at it and you really looked at the results, like, until you have a huge shift, until there is some, you know, until you change the scope of things. I mean, how many times are you doing that a year on a product? And why would you need to measure that monthly if you're only doing that twice a year? It's been kind of a cash cow,
right,
for sample companies and full service market research firms. But I think full service market research firms are maybe feeling the heat of having that type of cash cow and relying on something like that to bring a lot in. And along with that, I think it's like a... I have this idea where like the market research industry is probably like a year or two behind everybody else or behind society. And so like, if you think about it, like everyone starts using mobile and tablets and you're never on your desktop. And then like a year or two later, we're talking about how to get mobile surveys. And then everyone is talking about DIY and you're watching HGTV and you're redoing the backsplash at your house. And then we're coming up with DIY dashboards for, you know, programming, field work, anything. And right now, our industry, you know, really into trackers and maybe like some big data and these huge monstrous projects. But society seems to be making a shift towards more like a craft type. So, you know, craft bourbon, craft beers, buy local, all these type of like these more smaller scaled where you get so much more richness out of whatever you're consuming. I think research could make that shift as well. And that's why I put 5 Atom bucks towards qual at scale. Because I really feel like as much as that may seem like taking a step backwards, the richer the data that we can have, the more in tuned with our actual customers. You know, the idea of grabbing an entire community or getting everybody is kind of, you know, there's so many different choices, whether it's media, products, anything. I think that a kind of a more craft approach to things, a small batch type approach, is something that I think is really going to take off in our industry in the next few years.
That is super interesting. Are you seeing, like, in your business, because you obviously service, I mean, your whole business is predicated around completes. So
right.
Qualitative does a lot less completes than quantitative. Are you seeing an influx of qualitative companies looking for digital sample?
A little bit, yeah. Or just trying to find people more. I'm seeing smaller quant studies. And when we are doing quant studies, it's what can we get with the quant study? Like, can what can we append to it? Can we do phone follow-ups? You know, would people be willing to join a community afterwards? So trying to get more and try to incorporate more qual into it. It doesn't help, you know, some of the bigger companies that I feel like as far as noise in the industry, like companies like Schlesinger, starting to grow kind of a quant aspect and then trying to put qual into it. Companies like 2020 that are developing softwares, you know, and you know, taking things like iModerate, which is like kind of getting dusty and try to, you know, make that something more like qualitative companies are becoming more innovative in how they're doing things. And along with, you know, the huge boom from a couple of years ago of MROCs and things like that and what Vision Critical and C-Space and those type of companies are doing. So I think that qual is rebounding a little bit. It's been slow because all the money seems to be in quant, and quant sample suppliers are the loudest voices in a room a lot of times.
Right. Well, and the biggest, because they have the biggest budgets, right?
That's right. Right. And they sponsor everything. So, but I definitely feel like qual, like that is something that can grow a lot.
Well, it's interesting when you pull it back at the end of the day, you know, if we have a small company, I can, if, let's say it's 5-6 customers, I can talk to each one of my customers monthly and know how the company's progressing, how I'm doing, my company's delivering, et cetera, right? So it's as companies scale, then all of a sudden it becomes necessary to conduct a survey because, and that's really just a surrogate conversation. What qualitative is doing through machine learning, AI, sentiment analysis, whatever, is enabling a true conversation to happen, but analyzed at scale.
Right. And it's very similar to why I think those trackers are going to go away. Right. I mean, I always look at like the example of like the biggest TV shows ever watched. You said like the MASH finale got like 85 million or something. Like it was unbelievable. Like,
totally.
Like 70% of the country is watching the MASH finale. But at the same time, you know, they were four channels and like, what else are you doing? Right.
Right.
And there's no internet. Right. And so now like you look at, like people will say like the NFL ratings are down. I'm like, yeah, the NFL ratings are down, but there's also 1,000 channels and we have the internet and there's, you know, movies are better than they've ever have been. And like TV is better. You can watch things on, you know, Hulu original, Amazon, Netflix. There's other types of sports. There's esports and, you know, there's all kinds of other, along with those 1,000 channels, there's like 40 other TV sports you could watch. And so the options are so much greater. And so this idea that everyone's going to watch the NFL and everyone needs to be surveyed and we need to go all this broad, like that's just not reality anymore. And so I think brands probably have to think of it the same way as like, we need to know our total universe. We need to reach out to everybody. We need to sell everybody this type of speaker or whatever. No, you need to sell like to your group. You need to know what your loyalists, what your fans are, what your like your key demographic and how to do those and get rich conversations, get qual with them. And then that's where you're ultimately going to make the most money as a company. And I think we're finally starting to realize that a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting as kind of piggybacking on your NFL point, while viewership may be down, you look at trends in fantasy football, which are significantly up, right? So overall engagement's up. It's just the kind of getting to your small batch analogy early on, you know, the consumer has the choices so that they can actually tailor and control to tailor their entertainment experiences.
Right, I agree. And that's the thing. And to me, it's... the one rub in all of this is that you think like less money initially, right? And so for somebody like us as a company, like for me to say that, you know, craft research is a big thing and they'll call it, like that doesn't make sense for us now, but that's the thing, like, and maybe I urge us to do here, I would urge all companies to do, and people are starting to do a little bit more of is, you know, you have to diversify yourself a little bit. You have to diversify your revenue streams. You have to think about like, you know, how do we adapt for where we're going instead of being stuck where we are? And that's kind of scary in this industry sometimes, but we're blessed also to have a lot of disruptors in this industry. And so the other thing, like I put $5 toward my qual, $1 each for VR and AR, and I put in $3 towards blockchain because that is kind of like the disruptor word of right now of where things are. And we're blessed to have disruptors in the industry, like, you know, like a Patrick Comer or, you know, or what people like the blockchain people are starting to do now. Granted, they might say that they're going to, you know, put the panel industry out of business, which might be a little bit too much of disruption, but it's good to have those disruptors to kind of push you to do different things. And so why I believe in blockchain and why I would put the investment is because it's just too much of a 1+1 has to equal 2. And like, if I believe that QualitScale is going to give me richer data and going to give me more, you know, engagement of my respondents and of my customers, then I have to believe that if I could, you know, have them link and collect passive data, if I can be able to append more data, they can have some kind of sovereign identity to get paid their worth for their beliefs. If there's more security there because of like the blockchain technology and how that works, like it has to be, you know, people say proof of concept a lot of times with investing, and there's right now it's just a logic proof of concept with blockchain for me. And that if we don't screw it up, the basic building blocks of it all add up to where it has to make the industry better.
I really feel like blockchain, at least in my understanding of the technology, it's being thrown around in a way like AR or VR, yeah, but it's a lot different than that. It's much more like online, what online surveys were to phone, right, or in mall intercept, right? It's more of a technology empowerment thing as opposed to a new thing, right? So it just enables better sample. It feels like that it's not a new dollar that the brand is coming up with in order to fund a blockchain investment for their research. It feels like it's the same dollar. It's just for a sample. It's just, you know, a blockchain enabled.
I agree with you. And that's something I've actually talked to Seema about this as well. Like we're talking like, what does that look like? But I think it does, if you are doing it right, and if you are incentivizing the people right, then you have a chance to, you know, I would argue sometimes in this industry, it seems like it's just the same, what is it, like $5 billion. And it's just the same $5 billion every single year. We're just dividing it up differently or whatever. So, but I think you have an opportunity to gain a lot of market share, and that the sample industry can be so broken right now. And everyone, you know, every year there's four or five, here's the secret that the industry doesn't want you to know about with sample, you know, or like Green Book comes out with something like that.
Totally.
And so this gives us the opportunity to eliminate those arguments a little bit. And I think in the long run could get more, and then maybe it evolves into more, you know. So I've always thought, you know, if I'm on blockchain and then I can connect my Facebook and my Amazon, and maybe I connect like something of like my Nest in my house, or something in my, you know, my progressive car things, to where, you know, I do a survey for a gym and they're like, how many times do you go to the gym? And I'm like, I go 3 times a week. And they're like, huh, your car says you go 2x a week, you know, right, or something like that. Then maybe like we could get a little bit more honest the better sample companies can make a lot more money.
Kind of like the new red
herring. Yes. Oh, exactly. Yeah.
I had never considered that, but that is you know, it's funny. So we're talking a lot about blockchain right now. And of course, gosh, 2018, IIEX, I mean, it was all about blockchain in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And this just continues to be the buzzword. And I just sat there listening to the presentations, thinking to myself, man, we are still asking gender at every survey.
Right, right.
Right? You know what I'm saying? So it feels to me like there's a lot of other fundamental issues that we have to consider when we're thinking about sourcing sample.
Yes.
That just would be a, I mean, how, anyway, you get my point.
No, I mean, you know, in a non-capitalistic environment, you've got a solo ID for every respondent, regardless of panel, and you could append like the basics to everything. You know, like, I mean,
which would be huge.
I mean, that would be huge, but for some reason, and get sample suppliers, we're all guilty of it, of like, we sell that as almost like a premium, you know, right, and it's foolish. We shouldn't be selling ourselves on targeting ability. Maybe we should sell ourselves on like how easy it is to work with us. Maybe like pricing, service, dashboards, visuals, those type things, instead of like, this is our stuff. All that could almost be the same, you know, same thing. Like, I mean,
yeah,
like a grocery store.
That's a really interesting world you're painting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, that is super interesting. Of course, nobody wants to hear that because you immediately move into, to some degree, a commodity. Although I will argue strongly that brands and buyers are thrilled to pay for a higher level of service and ease of use. Just that overall confidence to the researcher is what they care about. And I still argue that, or believe that, the value of research at the end of the day, it all boils down to how good that respondent is.
Right.
And by, you know, creating this race to the bottom in order to maximize margins, we're really, as an industry, doing ourselves a significant
100%
disservice. Yeah. right? Yep. And that's where we need to start looking at things like incentive levels for respondents so that they give a shit when they're taking a survey.
I'm with you. And that's a huge part. Like if you sample industry as a commodity, it's that we made ourselves that way. There's no one else to point the finger to than by ourselves. And commodity isn't necessarily a bad word, but if you're looking at margin percentages, if you're looking at those type of returns, then that can be taboo. And the more VC that gets into the panel industry, then that's why people aren't rushing to, you know, say the word commodity all the time.
Yeah, right. But you look at the opportunity for differentiation in kind of using your example of the grocery stores, think about like Whole Foods versus, you know, Food Max or whatever. So, you know, you do have big opportunities, I think, to win in both markets. So you could be a Food Max or I don't know how national that brand is, but
yeah, like a big box grocery type thing.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. You can win there, and that looks like one thing. And then you can win as a boutique-y type Whole Foods, even though they're not boutique-y.
Right.
On the same side.
I know, and people are progressing. Like you look at like where Lucid started and what their like dashboard looked like to where they are now, or what you know Pure Spectrum's done on the programmatic side to like make it easier visualizing for what you could get anywhere. You know, and Innovate, their new thing is great too. They have great visualization breakdown, like demographics of what things look like. And so we're starting to diversify in different ways, but the sample isn't where we should diversify, you know? I don't know.
Right. So interesting. All right. So we got to shift gears a little bit and talk about Qualtrics. I mean, that is, three weeks ago now, they announced their S1 and, you know, they're going public rather. And then right before they went public, of course, SAP bought them for a bunch of money. Tell me from your view, what are the three things that Qualtrics did that we as a research community or Insights Nation can learn from?
The first one to me is that they sold. And why I say that is that I think you could start to look. So there's almost like there's this disease of too much sometimes that we have in life, right? Like where you think, well, I could do this. I could do this. I could do this. And you start to push yourself in your bandwidth capacity. And I think where Qualtrics started as a software company to a programming company to then getting into consumer experiences that where you could basically do an entire research project on it to then last year getting into that, it almost felt like a CRM that they were pushing. Like I left Qualtrics thinking like they're going to go after Salesforce. And so it became so broad and they were doing so many different things. I think if they were to file for the IPO and you just get a lot of money, I think that could have grown more to where like you're jack of all trades and almost like a master of none. By selling, I think now they get a focus. You know, SAP has a lot of different arms and that Qualtrics could specialize in just maybe it's just that consumer experience. Maybe it's part of market research and not the whole, you know, kit and caboodle type thing. And so I think that it's great to be ambitious. Everyone should be ambitious. You should follow and do everything you can. But at the same time, I think this selling when they did really allowed Qualtrics to have a lane and to have an identity and a definition that will make them more profitable in the future than if they were to keep going and you know, conquer the world and or try to conquer the world, like death of 5,000 cuts type thing.
Got it. So focus, one of the things that benefited from them selling. Right. That is interesting. I hadn't considered that, but that has a lot of truth. Any other things that you think we could pull from?
I think the greatest trick that Qualtrics has ever pulled is how they get into their customers. And that is, you know, going to universities, giving the software to people, you know, somebody who's graduating from college can walk out with some kind of Qualtrics certification that maybe was just a piece of paper in the past, but then they go to a job and they're like, oh, I'm Qualtrics certified. What the hell is that? Well, let me show you. And then they have it. And then maybe they move on to other jobs. And it's like they start at such a young point in a researcher's career by introducing their product that it's magic. It is genius idea to start that young. It's almost like I remember, like, if you ever go to like a job fair or you walk through a community and you get like all these like cards on your door or something. It's like, oh, my first reflection of this community is this pizza place. I'm going to order from this pizza place all the time. And the Qualtrics kind of did that. They're like first to market for a lot of researchers. And I think it's genius. No one has done it yet, like after that, which is crazy to me, or since that. And I don't know, I mean, what you would do to have that same type of impact. But it's super smart. But I mean, I think that's something we can all learn from.
Yeah. And you can't get rid of them it's interesting that they were the only ones pitching to colleges. Yeah. And the contracts that they signed were, they were actually profitable. So it wasn't like they were giving it away, at least not in the later stages, after the first few years. And then they're multi-year. So, and it's literally, you know, once an institution like a university has installed a platform for, you know, training people, you literally can't get, there's, it's impossible to get rid of that incumbent unless they just go out of business or something.
I agree.
I can quantify that with my personal experience. I'm on two different boards at my local college, Fresno State. I offered a free license to the campus and they never gave me the free license. They are choosing to spend the money on Qualtrics just because they've already been there. So it's like that, unless we start in the high schools.
Right. Sure. Just keep going younger.
Right.
Right. I mean,
that's right. That ship has sailed. You're not going to be able to, it's hard to get that institutional shift unless you move maybe into like a niche offering.
Right.
And you know, we'll see what SapPoint's doing.
The last thing that I think that they've done that we could all learn from, and people kind of do this, but it's sometimes a hit or miss, is kind of like a universal identity and kind of bridging their product to who they are. And so what I mean by that is, you know, we are a customer experience app. You know, we're going to call our conference the Experience Summit. Everything is going to be experience. What are your customers' experience? How you measure those experiences, those type of things. And then they started making that part of their identity as well. You know, they give everybody there $1,500 to have an experience. You know, when you're at the Qualtrics conference, you can find somebody and say, you want to have an experience there. You want to meet a certain speaker. You want to, you know, do this while you're in Salt Lake, something like that. Like they are very true to their brand 100% in that realm, and it marries with their product. I think it's hard for a lot of people in the industry to do that, but they've done it really well to where, like, when I think of experience, it's crazy. Maybe I've been brainwashed, but like when I think of the word experience, I see that like X logo that they use a lot of times. So, that's a really good branding, from their side.
Yeah. It was interesting how they moved through, you know, I think their story, piggybacking on it a little bit, you know, they actually tried to get into the market research space very, very early, but they couldn't get penetration. And that's why they wound up defaulting to, B-schools. Right. One of the first products, or I think it was even the first product that they had, was this thing called a 360 review, which is where you throw up a survey, have all your peers and your friends and family complete it. And then it gives you this like spider web graph of, you know, how you rate yourself relative to them on a variety of attributes, right? And so it's just a self-awareness sort of opportunity. Well, it's a requirement in almost every business school in the US. So that was their, and it was really easy to productize. So they could, you know, the survey is always the same, the inputs are always the same, and the outputs are the same. So you could build a dashboard, right? And you could build a workflow. And that kind of was their model the whole way through. It was creating these products that would be easily understood and applied, and then just expanding it. I mean, I think recently they announced 26 or so specific use cases that had completely customized input surveys and, you know, process management, and then dashboarding, right, and reports, all centric to that particular business question wrapped around the methodology. So it's a really interesting use case, I think, about, you know, the who wins the old school Lego set that didn't have any like instructions, or the Lego set that comes with the Death Star instructions.
Right.
Legos,
no, I agree. Right? Yeah.
So tell us, what can we look forward to? We're at the end of 2018. What can we look forward to from the IntelliCast podcast moving into 2019?
Moving into next year, I really want us to do more interviews. And not interviews. My biggest interview, it's a lot like yours. Like, I love hearing the origin stories of people. Like, I want to hear market, you know, how did you get into market research? I want to hear, like, you know, that type of story, because I think, you know, everyone that you ask, almost everyone you ask in market research, like, fell back into it, you know, backwards. But at the same time, like, it's an industry that's driven so much by behavior, and like, there really is like a passion that everyone has. I mean, that those passions vary and they go in different directions. But to me, the more that we can do to learn about how people got into the industry, is more that we can do to recruit more people into the industry. And I think that's always a good thing. I want people to experience kind of what I've gotten from this industry. I want people to feel this like purpose that I've gotten from market research. And that sounds super hokey. And there's probably a lot of eyes rolling right now when I say that, but I just know like when you're in school or when you're trying to figure things out and like, we don't say the word purpose a lot of times, but you are looking for what your place is. And to me, market research gave me that. So I'm super passionate about it. And so if I can share more origin stories or I could hear more like how people got in the industry or why they stayed in the industry or how they fell in love with the industry, things like that, like that's my focus for next year. And at the same time, you know, my goal with the podcast, I've said this from the beginning, is like, I've always like, I love when there's times when we sell, like if someone asked me like, what's the perfect group to bring to like a sales presentation, there's always a passionate person who thinks you have the best product ever and they're like your number one sales guy. Then there's probably like a project manager or your insights person who is like all numbers, these are the numbers. And then there's a normal person in the room and they're the person like that will give you a wink or do they'll point your finger at you once or twice during it. Always like smile if you don't get something, they'll say, guys, can we stop and like, you know, think that through and like, what do you mean by that? Expand on that, those type things. Like the person who isn't thinking about market research from sunup to sundown. And I want to be that normal person. Like that's what I want our podcast to be, like the level-headed wink, nod, finger gun of the podcast industry. And if we can do that, I think we'd be pretty happy.
My guest today has been Adam Jolly, EVP of Business Development at EMI Online Research Solutions and market research influencer, host of the IntelliCast podcast. Thank you very much, Adam, for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, everyone who's listening. As always, I greatly value your input and reviews on whatever platform you're consuming this content. Please feel free to reach out to me directly at Jamin Brazil, the platform of your choice. Have a great rest of your day.